Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the reality of hunger in Massachusetts.
I utilized the food banks. I utilized the pantries. I got a list of the ones that were close by. I got friends to take me there so that I could get a little bit of something for the kids and I to eat, you know, just to make our way.
Also today, the challenges for right whales.
Imagine sitting in your nice home and somebody setting off a grenade in your front yard every 10 to 15 seconds for a year.
And author and spiritual leader Marianne Williamson on why she's running for president.
We need a moral and a spiritual awakening in this country, and nothing short of that is adequate to really fundamentally change the patterns of our political dysfunction.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. All week on WBUR, we're covering the world of food, from farming to health trends to robots, as part of our Future of Food series. Radio Boston will broadcast a special hour with a live audience tomorrow from WBUR City Space on the future of dining. And there's still time to reserve your free ticket at wbur.org/cityspace. But today, we're looking at food insecurity. Massachusetts is one of the wealthiest states in the country, yet 1 in 11 people struggle with hunger, according to the nonprofit Feeding America, and that includes 1 in 9 children. Families with children represent almost 60% of those who qualify for SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, previously known as food stamps. Shannon Yaramchek's family was one of them. She now helps feed others as a board member at the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. She also works at the Corporation for Public Management, which helps find jobs for people receiving public assistance. And Yaramchek told us about a time when she and her four children didn't know where their next meal would come from.
Back in at the end of 2012, I was married with four children, and my husband and I were undergoing some financial strain. And we made a plan for him to go back to Kentucky to where he's from and start working and sort of make a way for us to move back down there. Unfortunately, it didn't pan out. And the children and I were left here to sort of fend for ourselves, but I didn't want it to sound so bad. So we were pretty quickly evicted from our apartment because my youngest child was two and I couldn't work. I didn't have child care. I didn't qualify for any services or anything like that. So we spent about 6 months kind of jumping around from family member to family member until they could finally place us in a shelter. And when they finally placed us in shelter, we stayed in shelter for about 2 years.
And when it came to feeding your family, where did you first turn for help? You said you didn't initially qualify for SNAP. So was it to soup kitchens or food banks? I mean, where do you go when you're in that gap?
Absolutely. That's the problem. Like the first 6 months, I think were probably the hardest because I didn't have any benefits, and it was literally like, where do I go? And I would apply for, you know, I would apply for SNAP and apply for cash. And because I was still married technically, and he started working, it looked like there was income, but I didn't have access to any of it. So I utilized the food banks. I utilized the pantries. I got a list of the ones that were close by. I got friends to take me there so that I could get a little bit of something for the kids and I to eat, you know, just to make our way. And eventually, after several months of being able to finally prove that we were abandoned, I was finally approved for some SNAP benefits. And that, of course, made a huge difference.
I've heard you say elsewhere, Shannon, that, you know, being food insecure doesn't mean that you're starving. And as you describe your situation, you had food, but it means that you don't know where that next meal is coming from. I mean, can you describe what that weighs on you as a mom or your kids, you know, emotionally and mentally as well as physically?
Absolutely. You know, it's really frustrating as a mom who, you know, suddenly is the sole provider and solely responsible for making sure that the kids are raised and fed and clothed and housed and warm. And so it was a little bit frustrating to know I had a good deal of SNAP benefits, but getting to and from to utilize them was always an issue, especially when we were in the hotel. We lived close. The closest thing to us was a convenience store, Pride. So if I wanted food, I would have to go there unless I can arrange someone to come and pick me up and take me and give me a ride and all that stuff, because there was no bus that goes back and forth at that hotel. So that was an issue. And really, it's, you know, I think food insecurity really, really became a thing for me when I got out of shelter. You know, clearly it was an issue in the very early days when I didn't qualify for any benefits. So it was trying to just scrape by until something would come through. But at the point that I finally was starting to become stable, and started working for Corporation for Public Management, they took all of my benefits. So now I was faced with, I had moved out of the shelter. So now I had housing costs and I had, utility costs and phone bills and vehicle expenses, gas and things like that, on top of food expenses. So that, I think, has been the most challenging thing.
Yeah, you're making more, but then there are more costs that go with it as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really didn't feel like, for a long time, I really didn't feel like I had gotten anywhere. I'm like, this kind of feels the same as it did before. I mean, I'm grateful that I have a place to live and everything is, you know, covered, but it's still a struggle. And if anything bad happens to me and I get hurt or I lose my job or something, then we're up a creek, you know, absolutely up a creek.
So I wonder, Shannon, what policy prescriptions you might draw from your own experience. You know, you're in a much better place now, I understand, where you're providing for your family, you've got a job, mm-hmm. and are able to actually give back now as a member of the board of the Greater Boston, or the Western Mass Food Bank, I should say. But you know, what was sort of the key to getting there? I mean, was it education? Was it getting housing? Was it SNAP benefits? I mean, can you draw from your experience what some solutions might be to food insecurity?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the frustrating things about food insecurity and this issue is that it's not a standalone issue. There are many factors, many variables to what contributes to an individual being food insecure. And so the solution is not a magic bullet. The solution is something that would cover all of those variables, whether it be homelessness or education or mental health issues or recent incarceration. You know, all these are factors for keeping people food insecure. And the solution really revolves around all of those factors and really working as a community to fight hunger.
Shannon Yaramchuk works at the Corporation for Public Management and serves on the board of directors of the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. Shannon, thanks so much for speaking with us on Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining me now from Springfield is Andrew Morehouse. He's the executive director of the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. Andrew, thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
So we just heard one of your board members there, Shannon, saying that you know, the solution to food insecurity is not a magic bullet. But in your view, what are the best ways, best strategies to fight food insecurity in Massachusetts?
Well, clearly they're multi-tiered. And before I answer that question, I just have to say when I hear Shannon's story over and over again, I'm so moved and inspired by her, what she's managed to accomplish, what she's managed to overcome. It didn't come out in the story, but she's now gainfully employed and has recently finished school and got a master's degree in nonprofit management. So she's an example of what can be when society's like the United States should rally around its citizens who are, you know, struggling to get by and get ahead in life.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, yes, it's a multi-tiered approach to solve hunger. There is no one solution, at least in our opinion. You know, our mission is to feed our families in need and lead the community on hunger. So clearly we're going to feed people who are struggling to get by, who don't know where their next meal is coming from, who are food insecure, for as long as they need it until they're back up on their feet and able to meet their own family expenses, including food. But, you know, if we're ever going to end hunger as we know it, we really do need to address the underlying causes. And there are many. They are complex. And that is – they're going to take time to solve. But in – you know, in Shannon's case, what she was describing very clearly, which so many people face, is this notion of the cliff effect, where individuals who are at rock bottom and receiving some form of public assistance, which no one particularly wants to do but have no alternative, work their way out of it by getting the job training they need and a lot of good luck and opportunity to overcome all kinds of barriers to get a job again that hopefully will support one's family, but typically at a minimum wage income, that's not the case. And as you acquire that income, oftentimes, as she describes, people will face what's called a cliff effect, where suddenly because they're receiving income, they no longer qualify for public benefits, and therefore they're immediately stripped from them. And that puts them in a really precarious situation where they have nothing left to fall back on but this minimum wage income, which oftentimes doesn't cut it.
Well, is that what you're seeing more broadly, Andrew, among your clients? Because, I mean, as we look across the state, we see remarkably low unemployment levels. My understanding is that you're servicing many more folks now than you did before the recession, which might surprise some folks because you'd think, hey, haven't we recovered? But perhaps those people are in the gap you're describing. They're working. They are drawing a paycheck, but it's not quite enough to reliably put food on the table.
That's certainly part of the gap and part of the demographic of folks who are food insecure who we see, because we have to remember that unemployment figures are misleading. Anyone who works 1 hour a month is considered employed under those unemployment statistics, or they are part of the labor force. Therefore, they don't constitute being recorded as unemployed. So, you know, that's an extreme example. But anyone who's underemployed, they don't have a full-time job for whatever reason, and there are many, or are working full-time at a minimum wage job are going to be faced with food insecurity and potentially with insufficient support in the form of SNAP benefits, child care benefits, and other forms of public assistance. And so that kind of squeeze presents an incredible challenge on households. So we as a society need to come up with better policies so that folks don't face that cliff effect and are pushed off the edge and instead are incentivized with what we would like to call a glide path, where their benefits are gradually reduced as their income increases and as their stability in the workforce increases so that they can be successful. And in the long run, we as a society will benefit from that because we won't have to pay for public benefits for so many people who fall behind and between the cracks when they're pushed off that cliff.
So you say we got to come up with better policies. And I wonder if you believe that our policymakers in Massachusetts are thinking about food insecurity in a comprehensive way. Because one of the things that stood out to me in Shannon's story, Andrew, was that, you know, one of the real limiting factors for her was transportation. She said when she and her family were staying in that motel shelter, there wasn't a bus route right there and they didn't own a car. And so even though she had SNAP benefits, she had to just go to like the local convenience store. She didn't have access or ready access to a supermarket with fresh, healthy food. So I think when we think about transportation, we think about, you know, the pain in the neck commute. But there's a food insecurity element to it too, right?
Absolutely. And transportation is one of those underlying barriers or underlying causes, as we like to call it, to hunger. And particularly out here in western Massachusetts, in a predominantly rural area, even in our small urban areas where public transportation is inadequate, it presents a big challenge, as Shannon described. So clearly we do need more transportation resources out here in western Massachusetts, and any and every politician and almost any and every citizen out here in western Massachusetts will say the same and say that we're not getting our fair share from Boston and eastern Mass. So that's a perennial challenge that our legislative delegation out here constantly is chiming on and about. But there are many other challenges as well. You know, housing, affordable housing is a big one, and we know now that it's becoming an issue in eastern Massachusetts. The state government is taking a look at that as well. So there are all kinds of issues that I do believe our Western Massachusetts delegation and many in Eastern Mass are looking at in terms of how to resolve in a forward-thinking, smart, effective manner. And until that happens, though, we need to put food on people's tables. And fortunately, the state legislature and the governor have been behind supporting MEFAP, which is the Massachusetts Emergency Food Assistance Program, getting food to food banks across the Commonwealth so we can feed folks. But an example right now that the legislature is discussing and we believe is close to passing the finishing line is something called Breakfast After the Bell, which is a policy that would mandate all schools that have high percentages of kids who are eligible for free and reduced lunches to offer breakfast after the bell rings in the morning.
Which I think is something they do in I think it's something they do in Chicopee, actually, where Shannon lives now. So there's a good example.
Absolutely,
and
a number of schools across the Commonwealth. And what we would like to see is all of those schools that have high percentages of child poverty offering that breakfast after the bell. And unfortunately, many are resistant to it. And this law would mandate those schools with a higher child poverty rates in their communities to offer that. And what we've seen is that every school that is initially resistant to that policy, but once they implement it, everybody loves it. Teachers love it. Principals love it. Custodians love it. School department, school committees love it. And most importantly, kids and their parents and their family members love it as well because kids are well fed. They can concentrate on advancing academically and they don't wind up down in the nurse's office complaining of headaches and tummy aches.
That's Andrew Morehouse. He's the executive director of the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Again, my pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, this conversation about food insecurity is part of a WBUR series running all week about the future of food. Tomorrow, we'll have a special live broadcast of Radio Boston on food. Join us at WBUR City Space at 3 o'clock. Our guests are the culinary Oprah, L. Simone Scott of America's Test Kitchen, James Beard Award-winning chef Tony Messina, and Ron Shake, the force behind Panera Bread, Life Alive, and Tate. Plus, we'll talk about the Instagram effect on food culture. Get free tickets at wbur.org/cityspace. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. With summer right around the corner, some of you are probably already planning your beach vacations. And especially if you're headed somewhere like Cape Cod, that planning may include a whale watch. If you're lucky, you might even catch a glimpse of a North Atlantic right whale, one of the rarest species of whale on the planet. Now, you might remember we talked on Radio Boston last month about the delayed start of the lobstering season in Massachusetts. That was a result of efforts to protect the right whale that were seen off the Massachusetts coast. We wanted to learn a little bit more about these beautiful, rare creatures, so we reached out to Scott Krause. He's a vice president and senior research advisor at the New England Aquarium. He spent decades researching right whales, and while he's passionate about them, he admits that right whales look, well, a little bit weird.
Well, right whales are funny looking, to be perfectly blunt. They get to be about 50 feet in length, and at the front end or the head of the animal, it looks like it's upside down. In fact, many early anatomists published pictures of whales that were upside down because it looks like they have a big smile, but the smile is in reverse. And they have growths on their head called callosities, which allows us to tell every individual apart. So it's like looking at their face. And then the rest of them is black and smooth. They're very rotund animals. They have beautiful smooth-edged flukes that they raise almost every time they dive. So they're quite popular with in places where you can go whale watching for them because they're beautiful on the back end.
So in Massachusetts, people hunted right whales for a long time. We have the Whaling Museum in New Bedford, of course, and they were hunted really to the brink of extinction, right, in the late 1800s. And then the population sort of began rebuilding. And then since 2010, it seems to be dwindling again. What's going on? We were making progress, and then it's reversed.
Yeah, that's true. Right whales have probably been growing from very near extinction in the 1930s or so up to almost 500 animals by 2010. The growth rate was extremely slow. It was about 2 to 3% per year, but at least it was growth. And then starting in 2010, we started seeing a decline in calf production and an increase in serious injuries and mortalities from ship strikes and entanglements. So, you know, it's basic math. You start killing more than you start producing, you start losing population size.
And so right whales, they're baleen whales, right? So they eat by sort of like straining the seawater through
right.
their baleen like a sieve. And
yeah, that's exactly right.
And so they gobble up, as I understand it, these tiny little crustaceans. And this is becoming a factor increasingly too, right, as we talk about climate change and the impact on the whale species. I think some of us are familiar with the threat of entanglements that you described or maybe ship strikes. But some of the latest research that we've been reading shows that these tiny little crustaceans that they eat on have been moving because of warming ocean waters, and that's perhaps affecting whale populations too. What do we know about that?
Yeah, we're just learning about that. It does seem that, you know, the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than any other body of water in the North Atlantic, and that certainly affects the bottom of the food chain. And the animals that right whales live on are planktonic animal called Calanus finmarchicus. And Calanus actually goes through several molting stages, and its growth is dependent upon temperature. And so as temperatures warm, there's changes in the way they are brought into the Gulf of Maine and the way they grow up. And those changes mean that when right whales go to habitats that they used to think were big aggregations of Calanus, they might not be there now.
You know, these whales communicate with sound under the water, but that's harder when there's interference from, you know, ships and other sort of noise pollution. Can you fill in some details there?
Yeah, I mean, ships make a lot of low-frequency sound. Most of it's from cavitation. A little bit is from engine noise and just propeller noise. But most of it's from cavitation and propellers, which is inefficiency in the propeller. But what it does is it creates broadband, low-frequency sound that actually is occurring right in the same frequency that right whales use to communicate with one another. So one of my colleagues, Chris Clark, has estimated that the actual communication space, that is the distance over which an animal can hear and be heard, is diminished about 90% from the pre-industrial ocean.
Wow.
And so what that does is reduce the opportunities to communicate with one another, which may reduce opportunities to find mates, to find food, to keep track of your offspring, that kind of stuff. So ocean noise is a big deal. After 9/11, we shut down ports and airports on the East Coast for several days. And during that period of time, the ocean went quiet, probably quieter than it's been in 100 years. And during that time, while it was quiet, the cortisol levels in the right whales that we were sampling at the same time went down significantly. And there was a really big difference between that and all subsequent years. So it really does indicate that it's not trivial for these animals to live in an ocean that is full of noise all the time. And remember that in the case of shipping noise, these low-frequency sounds travel hundreds of miles. It doesn't disappear very quickly.
So how do we strike that balance between trying to create a healthier environment for the whales while also being mindful of people's business interests? I mean, so it's shipping, which we're talking about now. It's also, you know, the lobstering industry is a big one in Massachusetts. In fact, on our program just last month, we were talking with lobstermen who were frustrated by the delay to the beginning of their fishing season, which has happened a few times in recent years as state regulators try to protect right whales. I mean, this is sort of a longstanding tension. How do we find that balance?
I'll speak to the shipping piece first. One is that noise is generally a sign of fairly significant inefficiencies in whatever the machinery is. And when the airplane industry was actually criticized for creating all this noise around airports, the engineers set to work. They created quieter airplane engines, and it turned out that the economic value of those engines was paid off in spades, because getting rid of the inefficiency made by noise actually increased the efficiency in terms of miles per gallon of airplane engines.
I see. But that's people complaining about sound pollution, and the whales can't complain in the same way.
You got a point. Yeah. They can't complain. On the other hand, if these the cavitation is actually quite a problem for the shipping industry. It destroys propellers over time, and it's extremely it represents inefficiency in the propulsion system. So if you get rid of the noise from cavitation, all of a sudden you make propellers that are more efficient, and these guys will make more money. The shipping industry is fairly marginal. So that's actually a win-win both for the animals, for the oceans, and for the shipping industry. In the lobster case, it's a question of how we got here was largely due to the fact that everyone tends to think, well, if I'm fishing this kind of rope, if I could get a stronger rope that would last longer, that would be better for me. I'd make more money. And what has happened is that we have created ropes that are probably 4 or 5 times stronger than what's necessary for guys to get traps off the bottom. And I will say that the lobster industry has been some of our biggest partners in trying to solve this problem. They recognize that in the long term, none of them want to kill whales, and they recognize in the long term that the public doesn't want them to kill whales. So it's in their best interest to actually figure out how to collect lobsters for commercial purposes without killing animals. And the movement now is in the inshore fishery to go to back toward weaker rope that is more durable than it was, say, in the 50s when we were fishing with hemp, but weak enough so that whales can break free of it.
What would we lose if the right whale were to go extinct? I mean, I think a lot of folks want to save the whale just sort of on principle, like it's the right thing to do. But as a practical matter, I mean, what would the damage be to our ecosystem?
Well, I guess, I mean, this is an odd question because we have, many of us have this kind of intrinsic understanding that they're valuable. But in fact, it turns out that right whales and all whales do this very interesting ecosystem farming, if you want to call it that. They basically feed at depth on a variety of species, whether they're humpbacks feeding on herring or right whales feeding on calanus or sperm whales feeding on squid. All of these animals tend to feed at depth, and then they tend to defecate at the surface. And what that does is create a big nutrient pump. It brings nutrients and minerals and the stuff that happens at depth to the surface, which then filters out through the entire water column. First, it feeds phytoplankton, and then it feeds animal plankton, and then it goes on to feed commercial fisheries. And it's an indirect food chain activity that most people don't see or would not imagine. But the ecosystem value of right whales may be extremely valuable for commercial fisheries, and we should be paying attention to that. We're still in the early stages of understanding a lot of ocean ecosystem questions, but that's one that the link has been fairly consistently made.
So if individual listeners want to do their part, I mean, what can they do as the summer beach season comes up? You know, if you're going down the Cape, I mean, should you go on a whale watch, for example, or is that just contributing more to the noise pollution problem we were talking about?
I think whale watches are good, and I think that because people do get excited about seeing animals in the wild. There's this tremendous asymmetry between our understanding of conservation in the ocean and on land. On land, you say, well, we put up a national park, and that protects a big piece of real estate. In the ocean, you stand on the beach, and you look out on a sunny day, and you think, wow, everything's fine. There's no problem here. When you think about the animals in the ocean, it's good to think about that is their home. And if you were living there, if that were your home, what are the things that would matter to you? So, for example, we talk a lot about seismic exploration and how bad that could be for the environment. And so the analogy to that would be, imagine sitting in your nice home and somebody setting off a grenade in your front yard every 10 to 15 seconds for a year. That's the kind of impact that is happening in the ocean without us ever seeing it. You don't see it. You don't hear it. We don't have those capabilities. And so the same thing I would say applies to a variety of other activities in the ocean. It's good to think when we go into the ocean to do, whether it's aquaculture or wind farms or oil and gas drilling or whatever it is, what is it that we're doing that's affecting the homes of the animals that live there? And that includes everything from scallops and commercial fish all the way up to marine mammals and right whales.
That's Scott Krause. He's a vice president and senior science advisor at the New England Aquarium. Scott, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
We want to return now to a topic that one of you, our dear listeners, raised on a recent show. We had Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and incoming BPS Superintendent Brenda Caselius in our studio for a call-in segment when we got a memorable call from Michael in West Roxbury.
Hello, Mayor and Superintendent. I'm wondering if you would take up my air conditioning challenge. Since most of our schools don't have air conditioning, in the summer, as the hot days roll on, will you guys voluntarily turn off the air conditioning in City Hall and Bowling Building until all of our school and children have air conditioning?
Mike, are you a teacher, Mike, in the school?
I am.
Yeah, you did that. You actually challenged me on Twitter last year to shut down. Shut it down. And ironically, when you challenged me, our air conditioning was broken in City Hall.
No,
I'm just telling you, it was broken for a week.
So the Mike that Mayor Walsh recognized from Twitter is Michael McGuire. He teaches Latin and ancient Greek at Boston Latin Academy and is a parent of two kids who attend Boston Public Schools. And while that was kind of funny as an exchange, the lack of air conditioning in some schools can be a serious issue. So we called McGuire back to talk a little bit more about why he thinks keeping kids cool is so important.
Even in the month of June, my high school students are taking MCAS tests in non-air-conditioned buildings. Even the high-stakes tests in May, sometimes the weather is in the 80s or 90s outside, and most of the buildings that we're in are brick buildings. Temperature is really hot. And I'd also say every other government building has air conditioning. Why not the schools? And if it's not such a big deal, then the adults who run the school system should be willing to turn off the air conditioning, too.
Mike, help us put this in the broader context of infrastructure, I should say, and spending in the Boston public school system. I mean, there are a lot of issues on both fronts, right? I mean, there are some schools that are crumbling in parts that need to be taken offline. And of course, the school system, like many, has limited resources. So what's your sort of broader take on the way resources are allocated within BPS?
Well, for decades, the school system has been chronically underfunded, not just in terms of books and teachers and staffing, but you have to build in to your annual budget maintenance. And just like anyone who owns a home or a car, if you defer it for too long, eventually the price tag is larger and is looming. And that's where we are right now. And while it costs a lot of money, I would still say that it's a necessary part of 21st century. I see buildings going up all over Boston. We're in the midst of a huge boom. I'd like to know where that money's going. And again, if there's not enough money to air condition the schools, then I say there's not enough money to air condition City Hall and the Bowling Building.
On the money front, I mean, as you say, so you're asking to sort of chip into this over time or perhaps make incremental changes as opposed to a full, you know, HVAC overhaul. The mayor's not sitting with us this time around, but if he were, he might say, but look, Mike, you know, in the 5 years that I've been in office, you know, the BPS budget has grown by a couple $100 million. Give me some credit. I mean, do you give him credit for that?
Well, absolutely. Every bit counts. There are many issues that face our school system, but more and more, we're having kids do school programming, or I think they call it fifth quarter, is the summer program for a lot of the kids. Those buildings should be air-conditioned. And it doesn't have to be everything overnight. Even if they just did one or two a year, eventually we'd catch on. I'm in my 25th year of teaching. If they had done two a year when I started, we'd be halfway there now.
Starting next month, Mike, we'll have a new superintendent on the job in Boston. As you know, Brenda Caselius is arriving. What are you hoping for from her, specifically on infrastructure within the school system?
I'd like to see her bring Boston schools into the 21st century, out of the 19th century, as lots of our buildings were built then. And I'll give her credit. I'll give her a chance. And I know she's got a lot to figure out about our school system, and I'm happy to help in any way.
That's Mike McGuire. He's a teacher at Boston Latin Academy and the parent of two BPS students. Mike, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, 2020 presidential candidate Marianne Williamson on why America needs a spiritual and moral awakening. We'll take your calls I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. For some of the roughly two dozen Democrats looking to unseat President Trump in 2020, the decision to seek the White House formed over years in politics. For Marianne Williamson, the decision was more sudden. She's a relative newcomer to politics, best known as the best-selling author of A Return to Love and other self-help books. And she says it was an epiphany that prompted her to enter the presidential race. The nation needs a spiritual and moral awakening, according to Williamson. She's qualified for the first round of the Democratic presidential debates and is campaigning in New Hampshire this week. Williamson took some time to stop by our studio, where she joins me now. Hello there, Marianne. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you in this conversation as well. Which issues are most important to you in the 2020 campaign? And what questions do you have for presidential candidate Marianne Williamson? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Marianne, can we begin by just talking a little bit about this epiphany that you had? As I mentioned, you haven't, you know, served years and years in the Senate and sort of been building logically toward this move. This is something you say arrived quite suddenly. How did it happen?
Well, actually, that's not actually accurate. I don't think of it as an epiphany. I might have at some point said that I had a moment of thinking perhaps I would do it. But you don't run for president impulsively. It's not an impulsive decision, and it wasn't a sudden decision for me. There was a moment that seemed kind of startling when the idea first sort of entered my consciousness.
But you had been thinking about it for a while then.
Well, remember, I wrote my first book about politics in 1997. This is not something, you know, it's not like politicians sit around and think about America deeply and the rest of us don't. As a matter of fact, I wonder sometimes if they're the ones having the deepest conversations. My book, Healing the Soul of America, came out in 1997. So I've been a political activist for decades. This was not some sudden thing that I woke up one day, oh, I think I'll run for president. And even when the idea came to me, as I'm sure this is true of anybody running, it was another year and a half that followed that of deep processing. So, no, it wasn't just an epiphany and it wasn't a sudden decision. That's just not the way it went down.
But what actually compelled you to you know, really actually jump in? So, as you say, you've been thinking critically about politics for a couple of decades now, but didn't jump in previous cycles. So what about this time around made you say, this is my time?
Well, I think like everybody else I know and like millions of other Americans, the election of Donald Trump changes everything. And I think that I, like probably every one of your listeners, has asked in our own way, how might I best serve? How might I best help? In what way can my skill set, my radio show, my whatever, be part of the revolutionary change, the resistance, and so forth? I'm no different than anyone else in that way.
So you were in New Hampshire just this morning before coming down to Boston to visit with us. And I understand you spent time at an immigration solidarity vigil, which was put on by the Faith Action and Granite State Organizing Project. Tell us a little bit about that event and where immigration fits into your agenda for the country.
My father was an immigration lawyer, and my brother is an immigration lawyer. So this has been part of my my value system since I was a child, the deep realization of the plight of the immigrant, the gifts that the immigrant brings, realization of my own family story. All four of my grandparents came here through Ellis Island. When I was a little girl, my parents would take me to the ceremonies where the immigrant becomes a citizen. So I've been aware forever. The fact that the immigrant, the average immigrant knows more about American politics, American civics, and American history than does the average American who was born here. And always a realization that not only does this country give such a gift to the immigrant, but the immigrant gives such a gift to us. So I believe that not only the president's policies, horrific things such as family separation at the border, children in cages, and so forth, as bad as the policies are, the transgression against the values on which we stand, it's even more damaging to the soul of this country. And I do think that, like millions of other people, his horrifyingly racist, mean-spirited, I believe in even criminal policies. Because the last thing I knew kidnapping is a crime. And if you're criminalizing behavior that's not criminal, seeking asylum is not a crime. If you're criminalizing something that's not criminal, what does that make you? So yes, immigration for me, as for so many people, this is one of the issues that has made me rise up and say, that's it, no more. I'm doing whatever I possibly can.
We're talking with 2020 presidential candidate Marianne Williamson, and we'd like you to join our conversation as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joe is calling from Winchester. Joe, what's your question for Marianne?
Hi. Well, it's you're right about the decline in spirituality. I mean, I remember just the idea that the United States was committing torture. And that was okay with people. That was okay. And they said, yeah, it's waterboarding. It's okay. It's enhanced interrogation. I never thought I'd see the country at that place. And it's even worse now with this guy there. But I saw Marianne Williamson many years ago in Anaheim. I believe she had taken Course in Miracle books into Russia. And I remember seeing her speak, hundreds of people in the room. And it was the only time in my life, Marianne, that I actually saw an aura. From out of your head on both sides came this golden glow, and I went from one end of the room to the other, and it was always there. And I've never forgotten it, and you've impressed me greatly, and I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I appreciate that.
What about on the sort of policy matters that Joe's bringing up, too, on sort of our standing in the world? He's talking about waterboarding. These are practices that well predate this administration. So as we think back, I mean, what he's talking about is really a couple decades of erosion in his view.
Well, there's very little, however, in previous administrations that can match this. For the sake of a $350 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia, we're willing to give aerial support in a genocidal war that Saudi Arabia is prosecuting against the Yemenis. Tens of thousands of people have starved due to that war, many of them children whose pictures are all over the internet. This is the kind of thing that would make our grandparents, our great-grandparents roll over in their graves. I don't think anyone in the world ever thought we always actualized our principles, but I think we were known for trying most of the time. We have so sacrificed our moral leadership internationally. The Dalai Lama himself said to me, people of the world do not look at the United States as some great champion of democracy. And when Mike Pompeo was asked specifically about the war against Yemen, and it's interesting, of course, that there was a bipartisan effort to stop American involvement. And, of course, the president overrode that. Now Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, says it's a national emergency, right to sell more arms to Saudi Arabia. But I saw in an interview where Pompeo, when he was asked about the horrifying immorality of our willingness to give support to this war, his response was the following. He said, well, sometimes you can have strategic partnerships with people who do not share your values. Excuse me. No, you can't. That means you have sacrificed your values. And as you said before, that's why I'm running for president.
But if you're commander-in-chief, you do have to make some really tough decisions about war and peace, right? I know that you'd like to establish something called the Department of Peace, right? But so, I mean, does that mean, you know, staying out of foreign wars to preserve peace if it's a regime that is committing atrocities against its people? I'm thinking of like a North Korea, let's say. You know, do you avoid war with North Korea, for example, at all costs?
Well, I don't think any sane person is suggesting regime change in North Korea. You know, there are many dictatorships and even evil dictatorships where human rights abuses against their people is common, unfortunately. The United States, however, is not going around and invading them all. And I don't believe that it was the cruelty of Saddam Hussein against his people that made us invade Iraq. I think that was used to exploit and to manipulate the emotions of the American people in order to get the American people to go along. However, I do believe there is such a thing as a righteous war. I certainly would have entered World War II. And I do believe that when there is an attack on an ally, when there is a real threat to the humanitarian order of the world, or obviously an attack on our homeland, that the use of military force is justified. President Clinton has said that his greatest regret is that he did not militarily intervene in Rwanda. And I agree with that. At the time, I was pulling my hair out wondering why he wasn't. So the fact that we need to move from a war economy to a peace economy does not mean that I don't see a legitimate use of the military. I have great respect for the military. But when you look at the $718 billion military budget, for instance, I don't think any sane or intellectually honest observer believes that $718 billion is only aligned with legitimate security concerns of the United States. It is aligned even more with the short-term maximization of defense contractors. Let's not forget the current head of the Defense Department is a 30-year executive at Boeing.
Let's take another call. Amory is in Sherburn. Amory, what are you wondering?
Hi. I'm just wondering where exactly you stand on health care, in particular to universal health care.
I believe in a single-payer universal health care, Medicare for all system. And I think the situation, the conversation needs to go much further. We do not have a health care system in the United States. We have a sickness care system in the United States. Western medicine is very good with dealing with acute medical conditions. So what happens is once someone is acutely ill, our health care conversation is, who is going to pay for treatment? What I want to have is a more holistic conversation, and that is that America needs to ask ourselves, why are there so many chronic illnesses in the United States to begin with? Why do we have such a high rate of diabetes, heart disease, et cetera? If you want to be honest about that and get real about that, then we have to talk about environmental policies, food policies, chemical policies, agricultural policies, even economic policies, given how much the tension and anxiety of economic injustice contributes to that which makes factors of illness more probable. So I want to talk about more than how we're going to pay for treatment once we get sick. I want to talk about how to increase the probability of health. And that would include funding such things as programs for diet, exercise, and so forth. When we do that, by the way, our health care costs will be drastically diminished.
Let me ask you the money question, though, right? I mean, so you're supportive of a single-payer healthcare system, a universal basic income, free college. How do we pay for all these things?
Well, first thing you do is you repeal the 2017 $2 trillion tax cut that gave 83 cents of every dollar to the very richest individuals and corporations. I would put back in the middle-class tax cuts. I would end the corporate subsidies such as the $26 billion that we gave in 1 year to the fossil fuel companies. I would look very seriously at what I believe is our bloated military budget. I would make sure that the United States government can, in fact, negotiate with Big Pharma so that we're not paying top dollar, so that we can negotiate as we should be able to negotiate. And I also think we need to remember that every dollar that you put into helping people self-actualize, every dollar that you put into helping people thrive is a dollar that you're putting into the probability of their creativity and their productivity. People will be happier at work when they're not so economically anxious. They will be better employers. They will be better employees. People who can go to college will have a higher standard of living. That means there's more of a consumer base. That means there's more of a tax base. We need to stop pretending that it's a zero-sum game and to remember that every dollar that actually helps people thrive is a stimulant to the U.S. economy.
Rama is in Gloucester. Hi there, Rama.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
We can. What's your question for the candidate?
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you, Marianne, for having the courage to do this. I've been, you know, reading and studying your books for, I don't know, 30 years or so, and I love you. You speak the truth. You're a truth-sayer, big time, especially about the health thing. It's really about each one of us to take care of our health and not be sick. But my question is, you talk about Department of Peace. God bless Dennis Kucinich. I don't know where he is now, but I wish he was running as your vice presidential candidate. But anyway, couldn't we give some more credence or credit to those people fighting for peace, put up statues to people like Abby Hoffman, like Martin Luther King, like all those people that have fought and some have died for peace, not just going to war. Yeah, I know there's some wars are just, but what do we do? People say support the troops no matter what, but what if the troops are not doing something that we support, like so many of the shenanigans over the last 10 or 15 years? How about supporting people who fight for peace and giving them statues, giving them hero status?
Rama, thanks for the call.
Well, first of all, we certainly do have statues to Martin Luther King, as well we should. You can't just take medicine. You have to cultivate health. And you can't just endlessly prepare for war. You have to cultivate peace. Even Donald Rumsfeld said we must wage peace. General Mattis said that if you're not going to, when he was head of the Defense Department, he said, if you're not going to fully fund the State Department, I'm going to have to buy more ammunition. What we have right now, I see the military as a kind of like a surgeon. So if you have to have surgery, obviously you want to have the best. But you avoid avoid surgery if at all possible. So who are the peace builders? Peace building is diplomacy, mediation, development, and four specific factors that are statistically proven when present to increase the incidence of peace and decrease the incidence of violence. That has to do with expanding economic opportunities for women, expanding educational opportunities for children, reducing violence against women, and ameliorating unnecessary human suffering wherever possible. We should see large groups of desperate people as a national security risk because desperate people are more vulnerable to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces. Now, we have a $718 billion military budget. Our State Department is $40 billion. And within the State Department, the actual peace-building agencies who do the work that I just described, less than $1 billion. The USAID, which is the humanitarian aid, which addresses all that unnecessary human suffering, that's $17 billion. And then the United States Institute of Peace is the whopping $36 million. So for a nation, just like for an individual, how you spend your money expresses your values. We're not resourcing an agenda for peace. We are resourcing an agenda for endless war. And we need to see the bigger picture. That is because, just as with fighting climate change, just as with healthcare, just as with gun safety, our government puts advocacy for short-term profits for huge multinational corporate conglomerates before a real agenda for our well-being or peace or prosperity.
Marianne Williamson is a spiritual leader, author, lecturer, activist, and now 2020 presidential candidate. We'll have to leave it there. But Marianne, thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, thanks you for your participation as well. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.